Live 2025. We've got some interesting stuff to discuss, and the first presenter will be Dr. G, who's the pulmonary pathology fellow at Mayo Clinic in Arizona. Selena, take it away.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. It's good to meet everyone. My name is Selena. Thank you for the nice introduction, Dr. Tazlar. So today I'll be presenting this paper titled Analytical and Clinical Validation of the Oncomine DX Target Test to Assess HER2 Mutation Status in Tumor Tissue Samples from patients with non-small cell lung cancer treated with trastuzumab, deruxtecan, and in the DESTINY-Lung01 and DESTINY-Lung02 studies. This was published in June of 2025, and here are the authors. So a little bit of background, I'm sure everybody already know this, but HER2 mutations are found in about 2 to 4% of non-small cell lung cancer cases and define a unique molecular subtype. The mutations are associated with younger patients, often non-smokers, and carry a poor prognosis, as we know. So trastuzumab deruxtecan, or T-DXd, has shown a clinical benefit in HER2-mutant non-small cell lung cancers and is now FDA-approved for this indication. But for patients to receive the T-DXd, an FDA-approved test is needed to confirm HER2-mutation status. So this test that they examine in the study is the Oncomine DX target test, or the ODXT, which is a next generation sequencing assay already FDA approved for other targets in the non-small cell lung cancers. And the goal of the study is to validate the ODXT as a companion diagnostic for identifying HER2 mutations in the non-small cell lung cancer patients who are eligible for T-DXd treatments. So moving on to the method, just to make sure we can see out of the way. So this was a retrospective validation study using tumor samples from two phase two clinical trials. So there's the DESTINY-Lung01 and DESTINY-Lung02, as well as some commercially procured non-small cell lung cancer samples. And then they compared the ODXT test results to, first, so they compared it to the TruSight Tumor 170 assay, which is an analytic for analytical accuracy, and the clinical trial assay, or CTAs, which are used to screen patients during the trial enrollment for clinical accuracy. So this study assessed positive percent agreement, PPAs, and negative percent agreement, NPAs, which are essentially sensitive and specific equivalents for diagnostic tests. So moving on to the result, I just made this table, that's why I'm showing this. I feel like it's a little bit easier to understand than what they presented in the paper itself. So start with the analytical accuracy. Comparing the ODXT to TST-170 showed 100% PPA, 99.1 NPA, which exceeded the FDA's 90% concordance requirement threshold. And for the clinical accuracy, compared to the CTAs using the DESTINY trial, the ODXT showed 98% PPA and 100% NPA, and 96.7% PPA with a LUN2 and 100% NPA with a LUN2 as well. So in the clinical utility, they found that compared to DESTINY-Lung1, the objective response rate to T-DXT was 58.3% for patients identified using ODXT versus 54.9% for those identified by CTAs. And the median duration of response was 12 months for the ODXT and 9.3 months for CTA. And in DESTINY-Lung02, the ORR was virtually identical, 53.6 versus 53.8, and around 54%, so around 54% data for the ORR. And then at the time of reporting, the DOR result was still immature, but it seemed to be trending similarly according to the authors. So across both studies, we can see that the ODXT only matched the reference assays in mutation detections, but patients identified by ODXT had comparable clinical benefit as well. So moving on to the conclusion and some practical takeaway points. So this study supports the ODXT test as a clinically valid and analytically accurate companion diagnostic for identifying patients with HER2 mutations in non-small cell lung cancers who are candidates for T-DXd. A key strength in the ODXT, so like why would we do this other over the some of the other tests, is that the ODXT can be performed in local labs, and it uses as little as 10 nanograms of formalin-fixed paraffin-embedded tissue. And then the turnaround time is also relatively shorter, only 3 to 5 days, unlike the broader panels, which often require sending the tissue out to a centralized lab, and then that would take a little bit longer as well. However, there are some limitations, such as in this study, so about 40 to 47% of samples weren't able to be used in the studies because and that was due to mostly like poor tissue quality, low tumor content, or inadequate DNA. So you can already see that this isn't a unique issue to the ODXT, but really just a challenge with most FFPE tissue. And another limitation that is that it uses hotspot mutation detections. So novel or rare HER2 mutations not included in this panel may be missed. And as we see in the two, there were two discordant cases in this study. And so in conclusion, the ODXT test demonstrate high concordance, like we already talked about, with both valid reference assays and the clinical trial assays using the DESTINY trial. And it offers like rapid, decentralized, FDA-approved solution in this case to identify the HER2 mutation. And yeah, that's kind of all I have.
Thank you.
You.
So when you decided to take this paper, I was hoping that they would talk a little bit about how this correlated with the HER2 immunohistochemistry, which is currently, the standard of care, right? You can't pay for, or people can't get paid to do this. This isn't FDA approved yet. So did they talk about how well the molecular testing, because I think that's been the million-dollar question for us. What does the molecular testing show as opposed to the IHC? So did they get into those data?
No, they didn't look into IHCs in this case, but I think that would be something very interesting to look at. Absolutely.
Kind of surprising that they didn't do that.
Yeah, I think in this case they were just looking to validate the this NGS assay, so they compared it to another NGS assay. That's my understanding.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I see that
Okay.
now.
All right, I will stop sharing. Thank you, everyone. Quick
I'm
question.
Gina. So for this molecular study that you talked about, did they also detect HER2 amplification, or this is only about HER2 mutation? Another thing, HER2 mutation also depends on where the mutation is. It
Yeah.
might not really benefit for the patient if the mutation is messed up with the membrane expression of HER2, that is useless for this targeted therapy, right? But I think the
Yeah.
where the mutation is, it really matters also. Did they talk about all this?
Yeah, so the ODXT is designed to detect HER2 mutations, so SNVs and exon 20 insertions. And then they do say that it technically can detect like high copy number variants of HER2, but the HER2 amplification overexpression was actually not validated in this test. So yeah, there's definitely some shortcomings with the ODXT test.
With that being said, I still think IHC is a better test than this one you're introducing.
Hi, Selena. It's Margaret here.
Hi, Dr. Kelly.
Hi there. Really good. Well done.
Thank you.
I don't know if you know this answer, the answer to my question. Do you know if our sequencing panel picks up HER2? I can't recall. In the one in Calgary.
Yeah, I believe the NGS or like yeah, the comprehensive CBC panel, I believe a HER2 is on there, but the exact type of mutations, I think it's quite broad, but it might be a question for one of the molecular
Yeah,
pathologists.
yeah, yeah,
Sorry.
yeah, yeah. It's obviously a growth area. I
Yeah,
think
absolutely.
I think you're glad you're missing our rainy summer here.
Oh, send some our way.
Oh, okay. I shouldn't complain. We're having yet another thunderstorm,
Oh,
and
wow.
I have to drive to work now, so I'll be in and out of the
All
German
right.
clubs.
All right, well, be careful. Don't get distracted while you're driving in the
No,
rain.
I'll try not to. Thank you.
Right. Any more questions? If not, we'll move on. All right. Thanks, Selena. That was great. So this wasn't a great month overall for pulmonary pathology articles, I didn't think, but I picked a couple of others to discuss. So the first one is ex vivo fluorescence confocal microscopy for intraoperative evaluation of surgical margins. And of course, this has been proposed as a way to get around the whole staple problem, I think, that we all know about. So they had 52 lung specimens from 51 patients. There were lobectomies and other, sample types. They had 71 staple lines and 8 anatomic non-stapled margins. So this fluorescent microscopy is, I'm just going to read their words here a second because, so it's an optical imaging technique providing digital sections of unfixed tissue without specialized dissection. It enables penetration to depths of up to 200 microns from the surface, regardless of their composition. And then the only prerequisite for good image quality is a flat spread. So, it's got to be fairly even on a slide. And then you preliminarily incubate it with a fluorescent dye. So let me just show you the next image here. Here's their image, how they do it. So here's the staple line, and then they put that down after they put the fluorescent dye on the surface. And then the M here is the microscope. And then the type of image that they get is this. So it looks a little bit like a Toluidine blue section that we're all familiar with from the Mayo frozen section technique. But this is what the tumor looks like here at the margin. So this is sort of the rolled up, margin. And I have to say, it's not a bad looking section. It looks a little bit like our Toluidine blue section, but they didn't have to take off the staples. So let's see. Oh, too many windows open. All right. So they had to, you have to use this specialized scope, of course, to look at it. They did it using this VivaScope 2500 G4. The stain is acridine orange, and their study design was to compare the frozen section images on the same material to the FCM images. Two pathologists evaluated the images, and overall, there was substantial agreement between the two ways of looking at it. So the benefit, of course, was that the FCM samples could image the staple line without removing the clips. The average turnaround time was about 7 minutes, so probably a little bit longer than a regular frozen, except of course, if you consider the fact that you have to take out the staple lines, then that probably is pretty comparable, I think. Their conclusions were that the FCM enabled frozen sec or visualization of the true staple line worked pretty well and reduced actually false positives compared to frozen section, had turnaround times with intraoperative workflows. I thought it was an interesting concept. There's no mention of training on the recognition of tumor, but when you look at those frozens, it really looks like almost like a Toluidine blue section. So they probably need larger cohorts, different tumor types. But this has been used in other settings, so they highlight that it's been used, for example, in Mohs and other settings. So kind of an interesting concept. I don't know if it'll take off or not. It is annoying taking the staples out, but I have to say, last week I was in the frozen section lab quite a few days, and we get pretty good sections even taking out the staples, but wondering if anybody's doing anything like this.
No is the answer. And I'm still, I guess, a little struggling to understand the problem there. I mean, I get the problem they're trying to solve, but if the margin is that close,
right,
I might want a little more.
You might want a little more. I know. Yeah.
So,
I mean, the images look pretty good.
Yeah, they look cool. I mean, it's cool.
Here's another image of a bronchial margin. And, you know, here's some tumor down here.
Just for curiosity, Dr. Pedalier, so you said when you do the parenchymal margin, you take off the staples, then submit for frozen?
If it looks really close, we will our PAs, not me, but the PAs will take off the frozens and or take off the staples, sorry. And they do a pretty nice job, I have to say. So we get a pretty nice section. Last week it looked close, and so to Christine's point, last week there was one case and I said, you know, it looks close, can you get us some more? And she said, no, take off the staples. So the surgeons are, you know, free to tell us that, no, don't just send us back, please do a frozen on the margin. And it was negative, you know.
That's amazing. Our surgeons, I think, are a little more liberal with just taking more, but I acknowledge they probably do more lobar and resections than maybe other places.
I have to say, we've been getting a lot of segmentectomies and stuff lately. Mm-hmm. And some of them, I don't remember if it was a primary or a met. I don't remember mm-hmm. the setting that we were looking at last week, but more than I think we used to, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So that may be our, you know, the practice is moving in that direction. So.
Another question for this study, they have a control for this? I know this is how it looks like through this special.
No, not really. I mean, well, their control was the regular frozen that they did after they took the staples out.
They did this special microscopy, then they take off the staples, then regular.
Right, correct. Yeah, okay. That was their control was the regular frozen.
Thank you.
Yep. All right, the next article is on long COVID in immunocompromised and immunocompetent patients, and it was both clinical morphologic, and they also did droplet PCR to look for the organisms. I think it was by droplet PCR. So it was retrospective weight, the morphologic and viral features in transbronchial biopsies. So these were all small biopsies. They looked for, sorry, maybe somebody knows, including subgenomic transcripts. I thought they probably used droplet PCR, but now that I'm presenting, I'm not exactly sure. So they had to have SARS-CoV-2 pneumonia at least 30 days with persistent involvement on HRCT, and that was described as greater than 10% involvement, as well as respiratory or other systemic symptoms at least 12 weeks from the infection diagnosis. They excluded those with severely compromised lung function or resting hypoxemia, I think because they couldn't undergo the transbronchial biopsies. And then all slides were digitally reviewed for areas of fibrosis and inflammation. There were 18 patients with post-COVID transbronchial biopsies that ended up being their cohort, given the extent of damage, and roughly half were immunocompetent, and the immunocompromised were all lung transplant recipients. The dominant finding in these patients, perhaps maybe not surprisingly, was organizing pneumonia. And then I found this article really hard to read. The grammar was poor. I don't know who the reviewer was, but I sure wish they would have taken time to say, you know, you need to change your language. I don't know what post-hyalinization and remodeling means. There's no definition for that. I think what they mean is vessel hyalinization, but, you know, post-hyalinization and remodeling is kind of a weird term. So the long COVID biopsies showed lower inflammation than organizing pneumonia controls, so non-COVID organizing pneumonia. And then again, a funny term, despite similar fibrotic extensions, which I think they mean extent of fibrosis, but again, it's just worded really, really hard. So the dominant finding in these patients was that of organizing pneumonia. Vascular changes were also present, but they were also present in the control. So I'm not sure that's significant. They do suggest that the vascular findings tended towards significant, and that perhaps low numbers account for the lack of statistical significance. So who knows? The other thing about the paper is, I won't bring it up here, but if you have it, you may want, I mean, you can't tell what they're talking about. There's one low power figure that shows like the study design, and there's way too much real estate taken up by like the study design. It's like, it's not that complicated. And so I don't know why they didn't show us pathology images that would have helped us understand what they were talking about. So anyway, I don't think there's much new here, but there you have it. Any questions or comments on that?
I just wanted to add, I have noticed a number of papers I've reviewed lately have been similar to this one. I didn't let them through as his.
Good.
And the comment about the study design, though, I think what's happening is people are using AI to write the drafts of their papers, and AI in particular, I've noticed, because like I just reviewed a paper like a week and a half ago, and they actually said they used AI and then edited it, but the method section was so long and unrealistic, like pointlessly detailed, like talking about buffers for an H&E stain, and I think it's the AI, and it makes it seem like the paper is longer, and they're not changing it. So I think this is a real problem that we're going to be coming across, is very, very poorly written papers due to AI, and we all just need to be on guard and reject them or major revise type situations.
Right. Yeah, no, exactly. I had that with another paper I reviewed, and they acknowledged it. And I said, okay, it's great. It's maybe better than it would have been, but it's still it's still not publishable in its current form. I mean, here's those are the pictures. That's it. That's what they show us. They don't show us the funny vessels. So anyway, something for us all to be aware of. Okay.
You know, I'm also surprised. Sorry.
I was just curious which journal that was in.
Archives.
I mean, it may be something to bring up to Alan.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good idea.
You know, he might be receptive to that, because I've noticed too. Like, you have all this text, and then you have this photomicrograph that's an inch big.
I mean, if you're going to show us anything, show us what you mean by the vascular changes. I mean, we all know what organizing pneumonia looks like, right? I mean, it's fine. I mean, OP was perfectly adequate for the paper, but I just found it very underwhelming. So.
I'm sorry. Can I ask you a question about the previous paper? Because I'm just looking at the staples. Because our practice is different. We don't take off the staples for our parenchymal margin, because our surgeon put in so many more staples, probably 10 times more staples than the picture showed. So that's why we don't take it off. Is your surgeon also just do that many staples in your lung specimen?
That's interesting. You're right. I think they have we use a different stapler than the one they show as well. No, we have a lot of staples. We're probably using this, I imagine we're using the same, or the surgeons are using the same thing at your place that they are at ours. That those staples did look bigger than the ones that I'm used to seeing on ours, and less tight, a little bit. So we're probably using the same thing that we are, but yeah, they take the staples out.
Wow. UPA is amazing.
Yeah, they are very good. All right.
Can I just have another question to the COVID paper, please?
Sure.
So maybe I misunderstood, but they took the biopsies after or when they diagnosed the long COVID, right? So after the patient had COVID, like for a couple of months and so on.
Well, they said 30 days. So to me, is that really long COVID? Yeah, just 30 days. Mm.
Because I would have expected more fibrosis, but maybe after 30 days, you don't have fibrosis.
Well, it says at least 30 days before persistent involvement and after at least 12 weeks from infection. So I guess they're at least 3 months, Anya.
Yeah.
They developed pneumonia after diagnosis, but they're at 12 weeks. It sounds like they were actually more than 12 weeks for the biopsies.
It's interesting that this was all organizing pneumonia and no one had like cicatricial organizing pneumonia or these kind of fibrotic developing fibrosis.
Right, right. I know, maybe I agree. I was kind of surprised.
Yeah, maybe.
Just little train
might have been the funny vessels, because I think that can be, those can be misdiagnosed or not recognized, like the cicatricial OP. It can look like funny things. I've seen it completely missed as OP and then called other things too. But we don't have a picture.
We don't. All right. We ready? Any more on that or the prior one? We're doing great on time. So, okay. And I won't belabor this one too much. This is looking at the next article by Wang is looking at the IASLC grading system and comparing it to the older predominant grading system. So, and they were looking at the prediction of brain and bone metastases in patients. So retrospective review, 174 patients with early stage lung adenocarcinoma. Again, like so many studies, they excluded mucinous, and that's always annoying to me. It's like people with mucinous deserve their own studies, you know? They deserve to be studied. Anyway, they took the predominant pattern and then the newer IASLC system and compared those. So during 5-year follow-up, 16% of their patients developed distant mets, and there's the stages of those. According to the IASLC grading, there were, 23 patients or 13% had grade 1, 35% had grade 2, 52% had grade 3, and they also looked for the presence of LVI. Both the original predominant grading system and the IASLC grading system showed a correlation between high tumor grade and reduced overall survival. However, there was a significant difference in overall survival between patients with grade 2 and grade 3 tumors only in the IASLC grading group. Under the IASLC system, there is some interesting data in here that I thought was remarkable. So, under the IASLC grading system, higher tumor grade correlated with increased incidence of distant mets in the presence of LVI. And these met-free survival of the 28 patients based on the IASLC grading and stage showed that it could segregate grade 2 and grade 3 patients while tumor stage failed to do so. I thought that was kind of interesting that the grading did better than the stage. The ROC analysis also showed that the IASLC grading showed better predictive value for distant mets compared with tumor stage. So, I won't go through the rest of the details here because I do want to highlight just a couple of other articles, but I just thought that the grading system outperforming the tumor stage was kind of interesting because that sort of hasn't always been the case. So maybe we are making progress. Again, I think it's disappointing when the studies delete mucinous carcinomas from the analysis. So, any comments, questions? It's perhaps a little outdated because I think most of us are using the IASLC grading system anyway, but no comments. All right. I'm going to highlight a couple of other studies. So the New England Journal had two articles on nerandomilast in patients with progressive pulmonary fibrosis and in patients with idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. And they do show that this drug does seem to, help these patients with these sorts of, pulmonary fibrosis problems. So I'm trying to find the sort of the punchline here, just a second. So in the progressive pulmonary fibrosis, it significantly slowed the decline in lung function over 1 year, regardless of whether the patients had been on nitazenib previously. So the drug was well tolerated, and it supports this drug as being a new therapeutic option for fibrosing ILDs, and it was pretty much the same for patients with IPF. And so, you know, another player on the treatments for pulmonary fibrosis, this is not yet FDA approved. I think it was talked about at our last MDD, and I think maybe October, one of the pulmonologists thought it was going to be approved, FDA approved. So anyway.
Henry, did they compare to nintedanib or pirfenidone?
No, like I said, these patients were on those drugs. They may have been on those drugs previously.
Yeah,
so that
but
was
we don't
not
know
an exclusion
if it's better now. Or...
No. They didn't do a head-to-head. I don't think so. Yeah, with or without antifibrotic therapy. I might have to look at the details, Anya, to see whether
they... Oh, I was just curious if they
did that. So that wasn't the purpose of the study.
Oh, okay.
So it might be buried in here. I didn't read it that carefully. You know, I'm sure there might be a table where they break that out. I just don't know.
Okay. Thank you.
Not all these patients had biopsy proven either. So these were patients who were frequently diagnosed on HRCT, which of course is the standard of care these days. So let's see what else
was the thought that it works by a different mechanism of action and then somehow can piggyback on the current antifibrotics then?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. I don't know what class of drug this was. I mean, I think it's an antifibrotic, but I have to admit, I didn't dig deep enough into that. All right. There was a paper by the Rochester and Arizona group on looking at rheumatoid lung nodules. Perhaps you saw that in AJSP. It was a study that Joanne sort of spearheaded with one of her visitors. And it was interesting that there's really not written a lot about rheumatoid nodules and how you tell rheumatoid nodules apart from infectious granulomas or from GPA. So some of the features that we found were that rheumatoid nodules consistently lacked airspace granulomas or non-necrotizing granulomas, which, as we know, are common in infectious granulomas. Necrotizing vasculitis was absent in rheumatoid nodules, but present in nearly all of the GPA cases. And the rheumatoid nodules showed a strong association with being subpleural, associated with overlying pleuritis, chronic inflammation, and then other changes in the background, like a cellular bronchiolitis. The basophilic necrosis, you could see, you know, really in all of them, including GPA, of course. And there was sort of a statistical tendency towards thinking that that might help you. But I think on a practical basis, that doesn't really help you. So I think, looking for non-necrotizing in the granulomas in the background and vasculitis might be the two most important features there. Any comments on that one?
So, this was not an earth-breaking paper, but the common notion that, the basophilic or eosinophilic nature of the necrosis may help, but it didn't help, that's one thing. In addition to the small granulomas are almost never seen in the setting of rheumatoid nodules. And one other thing that kind of was a little surprising was something like a follicular bronchiolitis was not really helpful it certainly is supportive of rheumatoid nodules, but it was seen in other settings like infection and the GPA. So it wasn't particularly helpful to support.
Yeah. I mean, I think, it wasn't statistically significant, and I think you're right on an individual basis. The granulomas and the vasculitis, the non-necrotizing granulomas and the vasculitis, I think are the most important things to look for in the background.
Did you happen to notice, plasma cells? I think sometimes struggling between, some of the GPA and infectious process, like plasma cells, I tend to think about more in the setting of GPA or something non-infectious. Did you notice that at all? Or I mean, it's such a hard differential at times.
You know, I have to admit that plasma cells were not entirely the target for close review, but I don't think it would have helped.
We didn't
take a look at that.
You know, the old teaching was that rheumatoid nodules in the lung are found in men who have established disease with high rheumatoid factor titers. I can't remember the details from your paper if you found rheumatoid nodules was the form first of rheumatoid arthritis in any of your patients.
You want to take that, Joanne? I'm trying to pull up the paper to see what the clinical was on these patients.
I don't remember any particular clinical.
Yeah, we didn't really look at the clinical very carefully.
Yeah.
I think the other thing, though, that we've seen and we did notice in this paper in looking at the clinical information was that the other part of that old teaching that I carry around in my head is that the patients almost always have subcutaneous nodules, and that isn't necessarily true. You can certainly have lung involvement without having subcutaneous nodules or nodules elsewhere.
Thank you. That's helpful.
All right. Back to the number of case reports. There's aspiration, there's amyloid, there's Erdheim Chester, strongyloides. There's an editorial. I wanted to get to the last bit here, which was the entire European Respiratory Journal was given over to the science of pulmonary fibrosis. So there's not a lot of pathology, and I didn't review all of these. Here's the titles. If you want to take a look at them, you know, increasingly, at least at our MDD, we're talking about screening patients for familial disease or for TERT mutations and those sorts of things. There's a lot of papers here if you need to give, you know, a basic science sort of emphasis in a talk. There's a lot of information here, but I did not delve into it any deeper than that. So that's about all I had, unless anybody else wants to bring anything up. You know, I don't know if you've all looked at human pathology, but I kept checking human pathology up until Saturday to see whether they had any pulmonary articles. And it still says that the June issue is in progress. So there must be trouble at the journal and then some July articles have been posted, but nothing, there's like five articles for June. So anyway, you know, we may be finding ourselves missing articles in human pathology because clearly it's, they're over a month behind. So.
And although the editor-in-chief is in our division, Laura Erickson.
Yeah,
she
kind
of begs for pulmonary paper. So
she's begging for pulmonary papers?
Yeah, she's just like, you know, we really need more pulmonary pathology papers. So, yeah, consider human pathology.
Okay. All right.
Well, ask AI to write one.
By the way, so maybe we want to go off recording right now, but I did use AI. I did use Matt's ChatGPT, and then of course I redid it for, you know, I went through it and did my own editing, but it worked okay. What I thought it was boring. You know, you have to plug all the PDFs into the ChatGPT. I did ask Matt to maybe fine-tune the output, because if the output looked more like our journal clubs look, that would be easier, because there's the formatting was, you know, different. There were like lines separating things. And so anyway, I asked Matt if he could improve that. But if anybody's, you know, used it, it worked okay. It wasn't perfect, but I wanted to sort of try it out.
I used it, Henry, with my last one. And it was really good for just formatting the summaries, because I used to just copy and paste the abstract and then change that with all the extra ones.
I see.
Because it takes so long. So it was helpful with that. But yeah, you have to keep uploading. I could upload 3 or 4 PDFs at once, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but it was very difficult. It couldn't actually format the document, the Word document. It couldn't do that. It was like a silly child who didn't know how to do it and kept saying they were doing it. It kept telling me it was doing it.
Yeah, I just cut. Go ahead.
I also used it when I did my journal club, and I had some issues too, because like you can have it an option for like notation or discussion, and it just kept spitting it out for a discussion. So then if I wanted it for notation, I would have to go back and edit it. And then I recall like one of my articles, they somehow combined two of the munosines together and like spat out a whole different number. So when I was like reviewing it, I was super confused, and I was like, I don't remember this like CD24. And I was like, oh, it's because they, for some reason, combined the two. So then I just ended up scrapping that. So it's a little, but like some articles it worked really well, some articles it didn't, but it was just more of like, I'm just curious to see how it goes.
Me too.
Yeah, it was plus minus, I guess. So.
Well, I asked Matt to tweak it a little bit. So, you know, give me, you know, shoot me feedback. I mean, I can take what you've given now as well. I'll give him feedback. I remember the term now. It's called hallucinations, right? That's the AI term for making up things.
Yeah, it was definitely hallucinating.
It was definitely hallucinating. So, all right, everybody.
Maybe it only works well on the papers that were written with AI.
Like I recognize my own work, basically.
Maybe. Yeah, right. All right, everybody.
Well, thank you very much.
Have a good rest of the summer. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks.